Presumably, if we knew how the genetic code was transmitted in these long chain molecules, right, and things, we can build these molecules. They are building these molecules, but they don't understand them all that well. Then we could put them together in such a way that they would provide for that part of the evolutionary program which is valuable right now. Part of that subjectivity is not valuable because it's a liability. It leads to extinction for those that find themselves in changed circumstances and have not the imagination to make the adaptation.
The only reason I raise this question is that there are some scientists, it seems to me, who have suddenly taken on, and some political scientists, who have taken on the aura of God himself and themselves, and that I don't think that these natural laws can be so ignored that even if they do succeed in making a perfect cell, that something is going to be there that when they reach that point, uh-huh, that there is some force.
In other words, it won't be a cell without it.
It won't be a cell without it. That's exactly what I'm saying.
It's possible that you could think of this as, let's say we had the stuff here by which to chemically pour in together the mixtures and do something, and you have a cell. A new unit of life starting with no ancestry as far as life is concerned, that in that could be theoretically a receptacle for the accumulation of experience, but there's nothing in it.
It's empty. A blank memory.
It's empty on the first one,
yeah,
and then from then on it begins to put stuff in.
Well, I think that possibly that's right, and the thing that concerns me about it, I don't know if it concerns me because I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow at noon, but I'll live till 2 o'clock tomorrow, yeah, so I guess I ought to be concerned. Well, at any rate, that I don't want ever to see the science reach the point, and I don't think it ever can, and I think this philosophy that we're talking about is tantamount to this, that where Baldy Harper, because he has discovered, or Dickinson, or McCallum, or anybody else, can suddenly fashion cells to make the perfect human being, because they'll be just so damned in imperfect, you see, without this thing that we're talking about, the subjective will, mind, etc., which is all a part of the natural inheritance from the creation of original cells that led to the evolution that we now are, and have incorporated all of the elements for millions of years of whatever you want to call human understanding of the individualism of each person to have his own course, his own uninhibited means and methods of creating more and better than he found it. And I don't think that Baldy could build such a person.
Is that true?
Much as I...
Well, all I'd say is I haven't tried yet. You see, I don't know yet.
We have such a satisfactory way of creating human beings now, I shouldn't think we'd ever want to make them any other way.
Well, that's right, but there are a lot of people that don't agree with you. And these are the ones that I'm worried about, you know.
Well, if a human being is complete, complete, and he has his full store of faculties, including imagination and memory and healthy physical function, physiological function, then by his Spencer Heath's look at this situation, you call that's perfect. So the unit is perfect as he stands. He's not necessarily transcendent. Depends on what he does with it. not necessarily creative, not necessarily using all of his faculties. Sure. So I don't really know what you would mean by perfect, other than that.
Yeah, it's not what I mean. It's yes. what the scientists who, the political scientists and others who want to create this perfect fellow in their image. These are the ones I'm worrying about, you see.
Well, it wouldn't have been something which concerned Spencer Heath.
No.
I don't even know that he would have discussed it for more than a second in order to get on to something else.
He would say, for instance, perhaps that it will either succeed or fail, and let them work at it.
Yeah,
let them waste their time.
I'm sorry.
Good point.
Dan, you had a question?
Well, agreeing with Mr. Dickinson, you know, so much of the material in Genesis looked at from the point of view that Spencer Heath is looking at it is so balanced, because the knowledge which conceives the life is the life. And if somebody really did play the test tube game, as you're suggesting, they could only get the sum total of the limitations that produced it. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be self-perfecting, which is probably what Mr. Ardrey, if he chooses to look at it that way, is really saying, that along with Darwin, the nature of the organic creature is to evolve toward perfection. But, you know, things like created man in his own image, and as you were saying, created in their image, it's exactly the same thing, and perhaps in the ascending hierarchy of consciousness, there are limitations with which we, in essence, were saddled too. But at some point or another, someone is going to do, doubtless someone has, a major thesis on the significance of Frankenstein and Dracula in these very things, because they're the strongest pictures of just this. This is why they've lasted so long. Because that which man creates can be no more than his limitation.
Well, this is exactly right. But those who are trying to create don't understand this.
It's incredible.
It is.
We're thinking through it as if the inorganic material would be utterly alien to life forms, that we'd be trying to make something out of something that wasn't consistent with it. And just as we're finding many of our human characteristics are in a much less degree reflected in the animal kingdom, so many of the characteristics of the early life forms might well extend gradually into the inorganic.
That's true.
So that it isn't a cutoff at each of these points at all.
I agree.
We look at the seemingly miraculous manifestations of out of the earth comes food or from the heaven, and yet obviously on the basis of this general premise and besides, common sense would suggest on the atomic structure principle that of course that could be done if you could conceive of it, because to conceive and then to do are not really so different if your conception is strong enough. See television, you know, it comes to you.
Well, another example of this is, of course, that if humans are only part-time humans for the most part. Most of the time they're animals, which is part of their nature. They're also physical. If you shot a man out of a cannon, he'd follow a trajectory which would be predictable from the laws of mechanics. He might as well be a cannonball, except that he's flexible, and you'd have to count. But if man were only animal in his nature, which is what most of the history of political theorizing has been about, then the modern American political institution is just ideal for organizing animals.
Correct.
They couldn't have had a more satisfactory technological solution for that kind of an organization, but based on the notion that that's all man is an animal. I think it's exquisite from that point of view. I'm not interested in studying it very much, but it does work that way.
I'm not quite satisfied to grant that the political process is well adapted for accomplishing anything.
I might be over-charitable there, but
you think he's underrating the monkeys.
Yes.
Point. Someone has suggested to me, and I'm seriously looking into it, the availability of a location which would have in it all the available accepted and unaccepted counseling approaches to help an individual understand himself, which would be, you know, absolutely phenomenal to have a person...
Cafeteria?
Well, to some extent, but there would be a regularized program which, like, you'd be taken through.
Sounds like Babel.
Well, no, it wouldn't be because of the nature of who would be there. But the point would be how... Back to unity and union. I mean, it's that same thing. Is the political only a substitute for lack of individual control? Of course it is. Or is that not
a
fair
statement? It's an expedient.
If it's only a substitute for that, then presumably...
I don't think you could properly call it a substitute. It isn't a proper substitute.
It is an accepted substitute.
It's an accepted and attempted substitute.
People turn to it for that.
It's an attempted substitute.
No. Who said you were attempted?
So whatever...
I'm in the minority.
Whatever steps can be taken, like this 858, to establish the unity would seem to go so rapidly toward the idea that if I could understand the nature of the component atoms of any structure or molecules of any structure, that I should be able to consciously reform them into whatever life I could conceive of, but it would have life only as long as my conception of it would last, which is something very different than the test tube stuff.
That's right.
Because I'm not trying to use a technology, I'm simply objectifying my subjective self. But at some point or another, this beautiful statement of unity, this is really one of this and the one that you closed the formal session with yesterday, are just beautiful. How is it possible for human beings to look at these three things and deny the fact they're related? Because all the studies that are available are so circumscribed that they cannot intermix.
You never checked this one out with Mises to get his reaction this last time.
I'm not likely to either. Mm-hmm. Maybe Dan could do it.
Don't know it.
You could talk his language. He's an Aristotelian.
Oh, thanks. I always thought I was a Platonist.
But you can talk that language.
I can fake it.
I have attempted to talk scientific epistemology with Mises, and it's he's already got some... His program is so complete as it is that he couldn't consider it.
This is right at the heart of a real major point of his.
This is going to go into it farther than what I'm going to read now. It's another form of thesis. Mises had a brother who was an empiricist, or a...
Richard, he was Richard. A mathematician.
Aerodynamicist. Very fine physical scientist, but not much of a philosopher. I'd like to... You're going to have to write herd on me a little bit better.
Yeah. All right. Well,
the one I want to read now is the scope of objective and subjective experience. And from this, you get more of an idea of what the problem of knowing something really is. This is very much inspired by Keith's reading Arthur Eddington, one of the great cosmologists and astronomers of our time. This was dictated to Spencer McCallum on April 21st, 1960, a rather late piece. Science teaches us that the physical world in which we have all our objective experience is a world of happenings or events. It teaches that these events have three measurable aspects which, taken together, we call energy, or more precisely, action. We are further taught that there is a certain magnitude of an event called the quantum of action, which is the least that can come into our physical experience. This, however, does not prove that there are no events of less magnitude. So far as the mind is concerned, we can conceive of any number of events having magnitudes less than that of the quantum of action. And I might pause here for a minute to give you an idea how small the quantum of action really is, which can be detected in physical experiments. The unit of action is the erg second, and an erg is a watt second of energy. And a watt is a very small amount of power, and a second is a small quantity of time. So a watt second is not an appreciable amount of energy. The quantum of action is about 6 with 27 zeros after it. I mean, in front of it, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
27 zeros in front of 6.07 or something like this. Wow, that's really small. A photon of light is one quantum of action. Just as there are no magnitudes beyond which the mind can conceive a greater, so there is no magnitude so small that the mind cannot conceive a less. The mind is not so limited as objective experience. A mind, therefore, is under no limitation as to what it can experience as a conception. The body, however, only responds to those events which lie within what we can call the objective octave, below and above which the body does not respond, just as the eye does not respond above or below the visible spectrum. Doesn't mean that there isn't any light there, the eye doesn't respond to it. But there is no ground for supposing that the cosmic spectrum has limits. Our minds themselves suggest this, for we can conceive no limits in either direction. So leaving the body out of account, the mind may conceive and thereby subjectively experience not only subquantal events, but an infinite range of such events approaching but never arriving at the point of no event. Who shall say that the mind cannot animate any or all of the events occurring within this minuscule range? Likewise, who can say that there are no bodily forms in which events of the utmost magnitude may be manifested, far beyond the physical forms of which we know? In other words, beyond the limits of objective experience on a large scale, we know of the large ones like galaxies. We experience those, but are we within a bigger cosmos than we can see? Is the reality we perceive, the universe so-called, is it just a microcosm within a bigger microcosm, so to speak? And below the quantum, who's to say that the subquantal things don't account for nonverbal communication and intuition and so forth? But the objective spectrum, occupying but a portion of the range between zero and infinity, we know to have been an increasing octave. As the minds of men animate their experiences, the bodily structure itself further and further, and perhaps infinitely, evolves. And this evolution may evolve metamorphoses similar to that which we observed in the lower forms of life. Our limited experience tells us of a limited cosmos, a small objective world in which the soma functions as a limited manifestation of the psyche. But the psyche itself has no such limits as the soma. It is without any limitations as to space or time. While the soma experiences no events of less magnitude than a quantum, the psyche can conceive not only within the range of what the soma can experience, but also, subjectively, events of both infinitely less and greater magnitudes. For there is no event so small that it cannot be further divided by the mind, nor so large that it cannot conceive of a double or multiple of it. Therefore, in the whole cosmos of events, the soma is imprisoned within a small but perhaps expanding octave, while the mind ranges infinitely between zero and infinity, two opposite but equally unattainable extremes even for the mind. No sooner does it approach zero at any degree of proximity, but what it can mentally get closer without arriving. Nor can it conceive of any event of such great magnitude that it cannot conceive a greater. All the events within that range which the body can experience are sensory events. All other events are extrasensory. The mind can experience them without any limitations in either direction. The objective octave. It's a beautiful concept. It, by the way, is not that it's not a radical idea in physics any longer for people to accept that part of it. They don't like to give much attention to the unlimitedness of the subjective part of it, though. It's unbalanced.
Well, the difficulty is that you can't communicate about it. You can talk about it in theory, but you can't describe. You can't paint it. You can't describe the lesser than the quantum, for example.
Only in the objective octave is there a possibility of a one-to-one correspondence,
right,
one man to another. It's that one,
yeah,
is the importance of the objective world.
There perhaps that possibility. As he touches on it there, you see it opens the possibility that you can sense it from another, but you can't.
Yeah,
by
communication,
this suggesting that maybe that's the
ESP or whatever.
ESP could be in that realm.
Just this sort of thing, absolutely.
Yeah. In fact, there is a paper in which he makes that specific issue, raises it, as perhaps ESP is a subquantal phenomenon.
You can describe a telephone wire, or even to some extent, I guess, radio communications, but you cannot describe sensory perception very handily, except as a thing, you know, something that takes place.
Well, events, this is not in the list, but I wanted to, this is on the units. An event is a unit. A quantum in physics, a cell in biology, that's an event. A human being in society. Every event action must be of itself a unit. If it occurs less than once, one time, it doesn't occur. If it occurs twice, two times, it is two events. If it is repeated, it is not the same event. It's two events. The same event cannot occur less than or more than once. Time, therefore, is what identifies any event as a unity. That's about all I wanted to say about this.
Is this use of the word event, is this common in physics, or is this common just on, is this Mr. Heath's definition?
This is, I believe, a Heathian trademark.
Yeah, yes. Okay. Would he abuse this today?
Yes. He would be more interested in this today than just about anything else he had been working on.
Uh-huh.
It would be recognizable to a physicist. He would recognize immediately that the unit of action, or quantity of action, is a whole event.
Yes. I get this. This is possibly just ridiculous, but the misuse of the word event by the hippies and others, you see, representing a peculiar social organization or activity on the part of so-called human beings that would confuse the non-scientific mind in relation to the use of the word.
Yes, but as he's using it here, it's a very specific
thing,
a threefold unity of mass, motion, and time. Being characterized by a quantity known as action, technically in physics, and having an infinitude at a given magnitude of different proportions of mass, motion, and time. That's your variation.
I'd suggest the use of a different word if it could be found. But I recognize that this is his.
Yes, and I find it very comfortable myself.
Okay.
Experience is the best approach to a subject. You should approach a subject not from the language, but from the experience itself, using the language to describe it. Every reality has a mathematical counterpart. But there are a lot of mathematical conceptions, I might add, which don't have any counterpart in reality. If you understand the rationale of reality, then you can describe it in terms of symbolic, a symbolic representation, mathematics. But just because you can come up with a mental conception of symbolic, a language, it does not mean you'll find a counterpart to that in reality. So Heath is suggesting that when you're approaching a subject, the best starting point is with experience. What do you know about it from objective experience? And of course, by the scientific method, that's where you end up too, checking base again. Well, I think I'll pass on the one on events because we've talked about it a great deal. And this was one, this item 38 on events has some great statements in it on technology as the resynthesis of events.
Now, what was the number of the events you briefly read?
334. The one I just read?
No, the one before that.
I'm going to forget the end one that's not on the list.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is item 94, events as unique units. And in this article, 94, Dan, there's a psychological rationale of the three fundamental abstractions, out of touch, out of motion, out of succession. And he gives a very cogent interpretation of how those fundamental operational units from physics can be isolated to just that. So I'll go on to quantum metaphysics. You know, Dr. Harper, you raised the question as to what he meant by quality. So I'll back off that and read one on the constitution of events to answer that query.
Don't bother with it now. You want to hold it later? You know, for me.
Maybe it will come.
Follow
up
your own later. Inclination.
Yeah, my inclination is that it will come up again.
I'll make a note to that.
This is a little long, and I especially want to get to it. Quantum metaphysics. This is from dictated, apparently, or at least typed by Spencer McCallum and edited by Spencer Heath, January 22nd, 54. Scientists are human. One of their weaknesses in common with others is their tendency to assume that things or events which they find themselves unable to fit into their experience do not in fact exist. In this they resemble the person who in discussion doggedly opposes a proposition or fact in terms of how the idea is being put forth by someone, or at least in terms of his inability to conceive or comprehend. If he can't conceive or comprehend it, he opposes it.
Or unwillingness.
You know, one way that he likes to express this, he used to say that people somehow have a way of feeling that what they're not up on, they have to be down on.
Yeah, that's what I mean by unwillingness. Yeah.
Or, as they say, I cannot see this or that or the other thing that may be in the course of presentation to them. They indulge themselves with this negative in all seriousness and often with the utmost finality. These persons are naively unaware that what they are talking about is really their own personal limitations rather than the subject matter under discussion. For an example of this in the scientific world, we may point to the supposed limitations of the quantum. The quantum has been defined as an action or event of the least possible magnitude, an event of minimal dimensions often called the atom of action. It has been well demonstrated and accepted throughout the scientific world that there is, at least apparently, such an almost infinitesimal event, and yet an event large enough that can be measured and experienced. The common assertion is that such an event is indivisible and that all larger events are made up of these units. Just as all material things used to be considered as made up of indivisible atoms, all of one size. The plain fact of the matter is that science has found itself unable to experience and therefore unable to measure any event or events of less than the given magnitude. This is taken as grounds for asserting that no lesser events can exist or occur, and that all quanta and greater events are aggregations of these individual units. Here we have what seems like the very arrogant assumption that the world of action, or events, consists only in that which scientists find themselves able to experience of it, that the cosmic realm is no broader or deeper than that portion of it which comes within the range of their necessarily limited human experience. It is not denied that human beings are finite, that there are definite limits to our various sense perceptions, a spectrum of energy waves outside of which our visual organs do not respond. The same is true of our auditory, tactile, and other responses. Besides these special senses, it must also be recognized that we have a faculty of general experience, a certain range of access to the objective world around us. This generalized sense or capacity of response, like our other senses, must be limited or unlimited, finite or infinite, relative or absolute. He covers all the possibilities there. It is difficult to presume that any human experience can be absolute unless we presume that the human being himself is without limitations. It would seem, therefore, that our scientists are more likely describing their own subjective incapacity rather than any necessary limitations in the dimensions inherent in objective events. They refuse to entertain that which does not come within the realm of our experience, much as our obstinate friend in discussion refuses to entertain that which he says he is unable to see or comprehend. Once we grant that these scientific limitations are in reality the limitations of the human capacity to experience, we have a hypothesis on which strongly to infer the existence of a so-called extrasensory world, a world which physical scientists admit transcends and yields not responses to the limited and experimental methods and demonstrations within physical science, which within physical science is by definition restricted. This leaves room for the existence of subquanta events, but no room for any physical or experiential apprehension of them. We can, however, experience their effects at any point, or points in our physical experiences where they emerge or combine out of their subquanta dimensions, as in the case of with visible rays, which do not affect the photographic plate until enough quanta have accumulated there, or at least enough waves have accumulated to make one quantum, is a better way of, would be a more accurate way of saying that. A similar example may be in the generally acknowledged mystery of, quote, action at a distance, like radiation. One of the great mysteries of physics. Something that takes place in the intervening void, yet between the magnet and the armature, force or energy does pass. The sun exerts a force on the earth by virtue of its radiation. They don't touch. It could be a complete vacuum there. There would still be that influence. That radiation transfer might be extra a subquantal phenomenon. It's really an interesting, a pregnant thought. What baffles us is that we have found in ourselves and in our apparatus no capacity for experiencing what takes place between the two. We only know that in terms of the behavior at the quantum and superquantum level of the magnet and its armature. If there are, as there may well be, forms of energy or action similar to those of which we can have experience, but that elude experience by reason of their subquantum magnitudes, then the mystery of action at a distance becomes comprehensible to our minds, notwithstanding it is beyond the range of our factual experience, such as feel phenomena of all types. These are figments of the imagination as far as their elements in analysis, but a field is an abstraction in physics, and no one right now at least would suggest that it has any reality to it. It's a mathematical construction. The possibility he's suggesting here is that a field may be a subquantal phenomenon. Working with such a hypothesis, we may feel assured with Hamlet that, quote, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, unquote. It gives us a kind of philosophy that takes a great deal of the mystery and anomaly out of what is called the extrasensory world around us. It opens a whole realm of the metaphysical which, though it transcends our sensory experience, becomes nevertheless comprehensible to our conceptual minds and gives us a larger or higher point of reference from which to understand and creatively manipulate our objective phenomenal world. Then let us give thought to the metaphysical, the extrasensory, as well as to the physical and sensory world of our immediate experience. We need and anticipate no disharmony between the two. We may rather infer that an understanding of both will enlarge our powers of self-determination and our creative and thereby spiritual capacity to incorporate transcendent aspirations and dreams to build higher degrees of order and harmony beyond our present limitations with respect to the physical objective world. Such understanding releases human nature from its prior limitations, enables the future to transcend the past in greater degree than it is already doing. He writes in here a purpose for having written down this. I made my comments during the course of the reading, so the rest is up to you. He believed that there was a chronological antecedence of metaphysics over physics. That there was a metaphysical phenomenon of inspiration before there was the first inquiry. And that all action taken towards finding out anything or doing anything with it was metaphysical, emotional. So I'll read one on that I titled, All Human Experience is Emotional. All experience is primarily and finally begins and ends as emotion. The beginning and the end is feeling and will. I think that's a little bit out of order, but in all science and in all nature, there are only two signs, minus and plus, negative and positive. All is compounded of these two. There is no third sign or aspect differing from either of these. When the forces of environment subordinate the will, when there are no acceptable alternatives, then the emotions are negative. Fear dominates and drives the whole being to seek escape or to make attack. The technique of personality becomes the technique of war, to escape or to attack. That is, when the forces of environment subordinate the will. In a crisis, I think, would be a common way of saying it. The level of existence is reduced. Destruction and decay are hand in hand. Creation is unknown. But when the environment, external conditions afford many possible and acceptable alternatives of conduct, then the will is liberated. Conduct becomes optional. The will is not subordinated or enslaved, it is fulfilled, and it fulfills itself. The world of external nature, unmodified by man, is his determiner, the master of man. He is its pawn and slave. His alternatives are few. Until he in some measure rebuilds his world, he must modify himself to it. It must rebuild him in accordance with its nature. He cannot grow and unfold in accordance with his. How then can man, how does man, measurable, break his bonds, redeem himself from the thraldom of his external world? The answer is simple. The answer is not given in this one.
He breaks off then. He must have gone to supper. At that point, meaning to come back and complete it.
He says that there are only two, positive and negative. What about zero?
That's nothing.
Yeah, but it's another condition.
It's nothing we can experience.
Did you ever see an Indian sitting on a wagon tongue? I had old Indian John work for me up at Deep Springs, and all day Sunday he would sit on a wagon tongue, and I would say, John, what are you thinking about? Thinking? I don't think. Why think? Now, I don't know whether he was or not.
I can.
That comes as close to zero as you can be, and I think there are.
As close to zero as you can be.
Well, yeah, but is it negative or positive? I mean, it,
and also that was an assertion. It could be that he had no way of communicating. What? So how am I going to get Dickinson off my neck?
It might have been negative. It might have been positive, but it was not nothing. Not even if he was asleep.
He had a set, you mean.
Pretty clear now that the mind is still quite active when it's called asleep.
Well, somebody.
Dreaming is going on continuously.
That's some minds.
They're probably more active then than they are when they're awake.
Yeah, that might be.
Is there anything there in that one you just read that bumps into the idea that there's not a negative?
Not yet. These are the signs denoting conceptions. Emotions, you see, are subjective. Mm-hmm. And the mind can conceive of a negative, that is, away from something. Away from something is what a negative is. Mm-hmm. So much less than something. Well, but you get anything less than zero.
But this is purely definitive, though. I mean that you could look upon that as being just mental action are all subjective thought is positive.
Which at some points yesterday he seemed to be saying, didn't he?
The point of view here is that the positive and negative refers to something else here than what I was talking about yesterday.
No, he's accepting an arbitrary origin here and then making from that.
There is a direction that he has in mind here, and I can say that it's toward life. That's positive. Towards life or away from it as a direction. The signs positive and negative denote whether you're going towards it or away from it.
Well, then the illustration that you used may not be the right one to attack or to retreat.
Well, the one he used, you mean?
I don't know. I thought that you did. Maybe you did. I didn't know whether this was...
When the emotions are negative, fear dominates and drives the whole being to seek escape or make attack.
Yeah, well, you see, this is purely definitive on his part, that I would look upon any movement as being positive for the protection of one's well-being, that if you retreat, it's because you've taken the positive action to which you consider to be the safest, the best action at the time, under all circumstances. If you, on the other hand, decide to attack, the same thing would be true, and those to me are positive actions just as much as a conceiving of a propeller.
I don't know if you intended it this way. You said you may decide to do something, attack or go away.
Yeah.
That would make it positive. But this is in the sense in which he means it. He's talking about a reaction to. Without a decision.
I think that's impossible.
Yeah, but it's a matter of the level of consciousness, too.
I think that's impossible.
in the matter of necessity and non-necessity centers. And, this might be something to bring up, to make a point to bring up later.
This comes up again in the
on this paper. This is 224.
Yeah. This would be an interesting
one. That's a change.